SA458, I'm not sure what you mean by that, has conditioned by the data of renunciation, kindness and gentleness, one can expect a happy destiny. Please comment how to make peace, be kind, be gentle, are dhatus. How it contributes to an understanding of a dhatu. Okay, a dhatu is a Pali word which means a basis, a thing. For example, you've got the eye-based dhatu, the heya-based dhatu. It just is a word just on which actually to say something which is immaterial, which is hard to put your head around. It's a conceptual term. So I wouldn't really worry about it. If, unless you're really going to get into Pali and get to think as a person in the time of the Buddha would think, to have their conceptual framework, then it's not really all that necessary. But what it really means here, conditioned by the data of renunciation, conditioned by just renunciation, conditioned by the essence of renunciation, if you like, and conditioned by the basis of renunciation, kindness and gentleness, one can expect a happy destiny. And that is obviously, that is the data there is referring to the second factor of the Eightfold Path, because I call it making peace. The Eightfold Path, second factor, Sammasankappa, is the three sankappas. Sankappas means intention, thought, will, what directs the mind, or rather direction of the mind. And that is Nekamasankappa, Vayapada Sankappa, Ahimsaka Sankappa, which is what we say here, renunciation, kindness, and gentleness. So those three words, renunciation, kindness, and gentleness. What I say, what's written on the back of T-shirts here, make peace, be kind, be gentle. That's actually the second factor of the Eightfold Path. So of course, if you practice the second factor of the Eightfold Path, it's right intention. Intention is karma, karma, good karma leads to good destinations. So that's actually how it should be understood. How make peace, be kind, be gentle, are dhatus. They're not really dhatus. Just get your sort of, put your mind free from trying to figure out the Pali way of actually understanding these things. Now, what is renunciation? What is kindness? What is gentleness? You know what those things are, and that's enough. That's all you need to know. That sort of make it clear? Dhatus, ayatana, whatever. You know that people get really confused about that, because there is one very famous saying which confuses the hell out of most Buddhists if they don't read widely. They say, there is a jata, a buddha, a sankata. It is the people, it's usually translated, the unborn, the unconditioned, ajata, the unbecome. And when you translate it that way, people think, this is Nibbana. It's actually a place, it's a dhatu, it's a realm. But dhatu doesn't mean that. It's like a concept. It's not a thing. It's not a place. And that is, again, a misleading translation. The atjata, the jata means birth. It does actually mean, it's called a privative suffix to a word. It doesn't mean un. It means, now, the opposite of birth, it means the absence of it. So it means there is an absence of birth. There is an absence of being. There is an absence of conditions. Not an unconditioned, but an absence of conditions. And that is a far more accurate Pali translation of that word. And it takes away all this confusion that Nibbana is a place, is a thing, is a state. It's not a dhatu. It's not a place. You can't call it like an ayatana. But ayatana is just one word. It's just like a thing. It's just an idea. It's a concept. But it's not a place. It's not a thing which you can touch. Unfortunately, the Pali, because it is an Indian language 2,500 years ago, some of its concepts are hard to get your head around. And what usually people do, and those of you who really get into this Buddhism business and read those suttas, one of the greatest pieces of advice is I was given personally from Venerable Nyanaponika, this great German scholar monk living over in Sri Lanka for many, many years. He's responsible for many translations. He told me personally, never interpret the teachings of the Buddha on the basis of one or two obscure passages. There are some passages there which can be read this way, which can be read that way. And many people actually base their whole understanding of Buddhism on that. Instead, base it on just the wide, largely repeated, the great bulk of Buddhist teachings. Base it on Eightfold Path. Base it on Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta. Base it on the Four Noble Truths. You know, the teachings which are repeated again and again and again, which are very clear, well-defined. But sometimes people look at these very weird sayings, and they can, because of the misunderstanding of Pali, they can interpret that just to fit what they want to believe. And they're basing the whole understanding on a couple of obscure passages and totally disregarding the huge mass of very clear teachings. That sort of makes sense? If it don't, never mind. Dear Ajahn, thank you for this lovely retreat centre. It is a sanctuary for us, especially when we need to escape this crazy world, even if it's just for a while. I agree with you. I like coming here to escape my crazy monastery. And a few people to escape their crazy nunneries. So it's always good to leave that place, because, you know, I always feel like this when people come to Bodhinyana Monastery. Oh, it's so peaceful, it's so nice, because you're on holiday, you're visitors. I actually live there, I have to work there, I have to fix things up. That's my place of work. So that's my office. So, you know, it's like, you know, you go there, you think, oh, it's nice and peaceful. But for me, it's like you're visiting me in my office, and it's my workplace, my monk factory. So there's a lot of work over this. I love these retreats, because I actually, you know, escape. And that's sort of the monastery just fall apart. Dear Ajahn, if an abbot or abbess are being abusive to monasteries and laypersons, should the laypeople allow this to continue? How should the relationship work between monasteries and laypeople? Thank you for being such a wonderful abbot. I thought they were talking to me when they said about being abusive. No, look. In the time of the Buddha, so this is our tradition. This is going back to the very beginning. So this is taught by the Buddha. You lay people, you've got to keep the monks and the nuns honest. All those rules of Vinaya, the 227 for the monks, 311 for the nuns, they all came about because you saw monks and nuns misbehaving. Or maybe they weren't doing it intentionally, but you know, they were doing things which were, you know, you could see were causing problems and causing people to lose face. And you started complaining. And then the monks heard you complain, and they told the Buddha, and then the Buddha investigated, you know, is it really true that you've been doing this, monks? He said, yes. He said, look, stop it. It's causing people to lose the faith. And it's only because you intervened that this, you know, the bad practices actually stopped. So, from the very beginning, you were involved. And it's not just the men, the girls as well. In fact, you know, you probably were responsible for even more of those rules, you know, by criticizing the monks. So, if you see anything which is wrong, don't just, you know, think, oh, it's just monks' business or it's nuns' business. I'm only a lay person. What do I know? Otherwise, we will end up like the Catholic Church with all these priests, you know, sexually and physically abusing sort of, you know, people in their charge. There are many wonderful Catholic priests, very wonderful nuns who are doing a great job, but there was always a few. And because of the few, that's why the lay people have to look after us. You know, in any organization, if self-regulation does not work, whether it's in the police force, whether it's in the government, if they self-regulate, so there's always going to be sort of corruption and problems. Just like any organization, the Sangha is no different. If we self-regulate, there will always be things hidden. So that's why, be open. You are involved. It is this wonderful synergy between the lay Buddhists and the monastic Buddhists. We teach you, we keep you honest. We criticize you if you're messing around, and you criticize us. Not from ill will, but for the sake of moving Buddhism along in a beautiful path. So So the thing is, when there is criticism, make sure it's never done with a mind of anger or ill will. The whole reason you're doing this is because you want things to improve. So you create a beautiful mind of metta, and the usual way, as I've taught in Nolamara for a long time now, sandwich method. If you're going to sort of criticize the Sangha, praise them first of all. Thank you so much for your teaching. But this is going on the wrong path. It's going to be causing a lot of concern to people. And then, so having given the feedback, but we'll always respect you. And that way, sort of, you know, abusive behavior doesn't happen. Number two, in the time of the Buddha, there was no such thing as an abbot or an abbess. In fact, an abbess was such a sort of an interesting word that when the first, when Sister Wayama sort of started at this here, you know, we decided not to call her abbess. But, you know, call her an abbot as well. Because abbess, many people started calling that abbess. So staring at the ceiling, I was staring down the abyss. And sometimes it can feel like that. So we call her just, you know, the female abbot. And so not calling it a nunnery, but the nun's monastery, it sort of sounded better, a bit more equity. But if there is anyone abusive, that shouldn't happen anyway, because it doesn't matter how senior you are, as a monk, you are beholden to your Sangha. So the first thing, if I was abusive, I would expect the monks who live with me to tell me off first of all. Because that is the power base in Buddhism. It's not one monk, it's the Sangha. The Sangha have the power, they have the authority, not one individual monk. So if I do something wrong, I expect the Sangha in my monastery to tell me off, first of all, to point it out to me. So that way, there can never be like the dictator who becomes abusive. This is how the Buddha set it up to avoid such things. You all know that just before the Buddha passed away, people asked him, who's going to be your successor? Now, appoint someone to lead Buddhism after you died. And the Buddha said this great word, after I die, there will be no leader who is a person. The teachings and the vinaya, they will be your leader. That's just a brilliant sort of saying of the Buddha, which managed to avoid so much abuse. There cannot be a head monk or a head nun of Buddhism. By saying that, the teachings will be your leader from now on. And so, even in Bodhinyana Monastery, they could actually say, there's no such thing as an abbot. Yeah, we give you respect because you're the senior monk, but the teachings, the Dhamma and the Vinaya, that's even more powerful than you are. And I respect that, and all monks and all nuns should respect that. That's our leader, that's our boss, the Dhamma Vinaya. So doing that, there should be no abuse. If abuse actually happens, the structure was not put in place very well to begin with. And here in Western countries, yeah, I mean, Don was our past president, he knows how we actually get our constitution together. We have this wonderful sort of balance of power, the checks and balances between the Sangha and the lay community. So I am the spiritual director, but I think it was actually Don coined the word once, a spiritual dictator. It's a joke, he's got a good sense of humor. And said, no, I'm not a spiritual dictator, you know, can't be that. So if I do something wrong, the committee will bring it up and tell me that that's going too far. And I have to be beholden to them as well. So those checks and balances are in place in the Buddhist Society of West Australia. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why we've been an incredibly successful organization. Because we've actually set it up in a really beautiful way. So abbots or presidents cannot be abusive. If they try that on, there's many other people who can stop them. So if it actually does happen, things who are abusive, if it's sexually abusive or physically abusive, in the West, you go to jail for that. So you have to be really, really careful. So any questions about that? Passionate about it. If there's things which I say you don't agree with, you know, I'm not the spiritual dictator, okay? Put your hand up and argue with me. Say you don't agree. Okay. Someone put a joke in here. It's not a question, but a joke. But I really respect jokes. Especially on Good Friday. This is a Christian joke. A local Sunday school teacher was telling her group of primary school children about the early martyrs, explaining how they were persecuted for their faith. She told them that Saint Stephen had been stoned, and one young lad, after some thought, put up his hand and asked, what was he on? Dear Ajahn, please explain the non-self concept in what happens in our life. How does blame come in if we have no choice? Exactly. Do you blame yourself or feel guilty? Or is it just cause and effects just working their way through? It's a wonderful concept, non-self. If you really, really, really believed it and followed it, it means all guilt would just disappear from you. You just can't feel guilty anymore. Who is responsible? It's just cause and effect. You know, that it's a good idea at the time, but you made a mistake. But guilt doesn't come into it. You acknowledge, you forgive, and you learn. And blaming people, what does that really do? Whose fault was it? And sometimes just people had to do that. That's all they could do. So blame and guilt and anger. If you see it on self, it just all vanishes. I've seen people, I remember just going down the freeway once. It wasn't a freeway, it was a highway. And got stopped at the red traffic lights. It was a hot day here in Perth. And we didn't have an aircon in the car because the Buddhist Society was so stingy they never let us buy one. That's not true. But we did have an aircon in the car, so I had the window wide open, and another car sort of pulled up alongside. And so I was next to their driver, and the driver had his window open. And he was shouting at the traffic lights. You can hear him, you stupid traffic lights. You know, I'm in a rush. Why did you stop? You know, when you, it's not the first time you did this either. Last week I was in a rush and you did the same thing. You saw me coming. It was as if that traffic light had consciousness, if it was at fault. Have you ever got angry at the computer? Actually, I did the other day. It's only the computer's caused the failure. Computers aren't malicious. Sometimes I think the way they behave, they look like it. Just like people aren't malicious. Like, you know, you argue with your husband. It's just a husband being a husband. It's a traffic light being a traffic light. It's its nature. It sometimes goes red. It sometimes goes green. That's what traffic lights do. You live with people, sometimes they get grumpy. That's what people are like. That's what husbands are like. That's what senior monks are. That's what nuns are like. So why get angry at them? It's like getting angry at a traffic light. So anyway, that's non-self. No one in there, so it's a waste of time, I agree. Will everyone achieve Nirvana, N-E-V-A-N-A, eventually? When they can spell it correctly, maybe they can. If you want to go to Nirvana, I'll tell you the easy way to go to Nirvana. For those of you who live in Perth, just in Manning Road, there is there's Nirvana Hair Salon. So if you want to go to Nirvana, go there. I think over in the north, I remember going past Nirvana restaurant once. That's over, where's that? That's over in somewhere in the north of Perth, Padbury or somewhere like that, Nirvana restaurant. We passed it one day. Really beautiful food. At least I'd expect so. Or if you want to go to the Nirvana Hotel, that's just over in Lumbini. I've been there. So I remember having my picture taken outside Nirvana Hotel. That's when you go on pilgrimage. It's a great place. And you know what we were given to eat? We only had one lunch there when I went on pilgrimage and stayed at the Nirvana Hotel. Fish and chips with ice cream afterwards. I always said you get fish and chips in Nirvana. And it was true. So if you really want to go to Nirvana, those are the easy ones. Nirvana Hotel. Lumbini. Nirvana Hair Salon, just in Manning Road. That's, what's that suburb called? Bentley or something, I don't know. Or if you want to go to Nirvana Cafe, that's over in Padbury. But in the real Nirvana, that's actually when you totally disappear. And that was a question Ananda asked the Buddha once. Will everyone become enlightened one day, or only a half or a quarter? He said it's a stupid question. There's no one here anyway. So, you know, how do you say everybody or no one? You're missing the point. Aja Anjali Bhante and Aho Sukhang. Could you talk about the first right effort, the effort for the non-arising of unarisen, unwholesome mental qualities? How is this done with kindness and gentleness? How does this fit in with welcoming all kinds of thoughts? Ah, if you're welcoming all kinds of thoughts, if you're acting with making peace, being kind, being gentle, that is called good karma. That is right intention. And the Buddha said, Chaitanang Karmang Vadami. Chaitana, intention, is the essence of karma. So by making peace, being kind, being gentle, you are making good karma, 100% perfect. Good karma. So you are taking away the cause of unwholesome qualities to arise in you. Sure, you got the old karma from the past you have to bear with. Old stupid thoughts, tiredness, all that sort of stuff will come in. But as long as you're making peace, being kind, being gentle, you're not making any more bad karma. You're only making good karma. Beautiful, perfect, 100% good karma. Which means, when the old karma just disappears, the beautiful karma creates the wholesome qualities. That's how it works. And it's incredibly effective. Otherwise, how many times do you try to stop unwholesome karma coming in? And you made more unwholesome karma. Come, get out of here. I don't want this thought. You get another angry thought. Look, one of my key stories, which many of you have heard a thousand times, but, you know, that as I mentioned, I've only lived 59 years. I've only got a certain amount of stories, and so they're going to be repeated. I haven't lived in a thousand years. So that was a story. I was a sixth year as a monk in this beautiful monastery up in Medang province, up in the hills. Monastery all to myself. Lay people weren't interested in meditation. I was just so pleased. They left me alone. All they wanted to do was feed me once a day. I thought, great. Now we've got a deal here. You just feed me and leave me alone for the rest of the day. So I had this perfect place to meditate. It was idyllic. It was even actually in the middle of a tea plantation. So as an English monk, I had as much tea as I ever wanted. And fresh stuff too, really nice. And when I was meditating, the first couple of weeks were just very nice. But then you started getting restless. And I started getting very unwholesome thoughts coming into my mind. Those thoughts were what I call unmonkish thoughts. Thoughts about old girlfriends, sex, romance. All the sorts of things a monk is not supposed to think about. And I'm a good monk, so I tried to stop those thoughts. And those thoughts kept on coming in. And I was really trying hard to get rid of them, and I couldn't make it. And they was driving me crazy. Now remember, I was alone in this monastery. If I had a teacher there, another monk, that would have helped. But I was on my own, facing a mind which was getting crazier every hour. And these thoughts would just keep bursting in. And I wasn't welcoming them. I was trying to get rid of them, but they kept on coming in. And it got so bad that one afternoon, or one morning, I just had enough. I went into the main hall. I bowed to the big Buddha statue. And I don't believe there's a spirit or anything in there. It's a Buddha statue. I just asked, help, help me. And I think sometimes it doesn't really matter if it's not Davis or Buddha's telling you anything. It's just when you ask for help, sometimes inspiration comes. And I got inspired. My inspiration was, because I was a Westerner, let's do a deal. I did a deal with my mind. And the deal was this. For 23 hours of the day, or at least the hours I was awake in those 23 hours, I would behave. I would watch my breath. I would meditate. But for 1 hour every afternoon, 3 p.m. to 4 p.m., I would let my mind think whatever it wanted to. The most weird sexual fantasy. thinking about old girlfriends, romance, anything in the world I would allow, I would permit, no matter how unmonkish it was, for 1 hour every day. Okay, mind if you want to think like that, I would let you, 3 to 4, the rest of the time you behave. I thought that made sense. But you know what happened? When I was trying to watch the breath, my mind still would not cooperate. All these thoughts still kept on coming in. And so when it got to 3 p.m., I was so tired. And I went up to my heart. I leaned against the wall, put my feet out and said, okay, mind, now you can think any sexual fantasy, anything, the weirdest, the kinkiest, the strangest, anything goes. And for the next 1 hour, my mind watched every breath without a problem at all. It was so peaceful. And that was true. And that was such a weird experience. But I learned from that. When I was fighting my mind, I was trying to be a good monk, trying to stop these unwholesome things. When I was fighting them, they got worse. And as soon as I just let go, okay, if you want to think like this, come in, whatever thought you want. Then my mind was so still and peaceful. I learned from that. When you fight unwholesome qualities, you feed them. You make them stronger. So be careful there. Don't do that. You waste a lot of time and it drives you crazy sometimes. You just can't fight these things. Because fighting is actually feeding them. Making peace with them, being kind to them, being gentle. That totally undermines them. It's like turning off the gas, the petrol supply in your car. Yeah, the car still keeps on moving, but slower and slower and slower. The gas has run out. There's no supply of petrol to the carburetor or whatever else runs that engine. And so eventually, that car's going to come to a stop. You let go. You don't fight. And the mind comes to stillness. That's the way the mind works. So that's how unwholesome qualities stop. By making peace, being kind, being gentle. It's beautiful. It's a much nicer way. It's actually the only way. Dear Ajahn, does the seven precept mean that we should refrain from listening to your doctors? Does the seventh precept mean that we should refrain from listening to your jokes, as these are a form of entertainment? No. No one would say my jokes are entertainment. They are suffering. And if you want to listen to the latest joke, I think I told this on, I think I did tell it on Saturday afternoon. There was the stupidest kid in the world. And he came into this deli. Now, the deli is like this 7-Eleven little shop. They sell small things. And the owner of the shop said, look at this guy. He's the most stupid kid in the world. And I'll prove it to you, just like I proved it to countless people. So he put $1 in one hand and about three 20-cent coins in the other one and told his kid, which one do you want to choose? And the kid chose the three 20-cent pieces. And the man said, the owner said, see how stupid he is. Every time he does this, he doesn't take the dollar, which is worth more. He takes the three 20-cents. The kid is an idiot, the most stupidest kid in the whole world. And about 10 minutes later, the man who was in the shop being served saw the most stupidest kid in the world and said, what's up with you? Why don't you take the dollar note instead of the three 20-cents? And the kid said, as soon as I take that dollar note, the game's over. So never underestimate kids. So that was a joke. Was that entertainment? No, I don't reckon. Next question. Asking the mind what it needs. That teaching is also what the Buddha taught. There we go. Majjhima Agama 1:7. Wholesome qualities that lead to joy and destruction of asavas. Third quality is knowing the proper time to develop characteristic or settling, arousing, and equanimity. That's very true. This is the knowing the proper time, but it's just how you know that proper time. You know, to do these things, whether it's the right time to settle the mind, to energize the mind. How do you know that right time? And of course, ask. So ask your body. Ask your body, what does it need? A lot of times people don't understand their body. They don't ask it what it needs. And that's why that you get sick. So ask your body right now, what do you need today, body? Ask your mind, what do you want? What do you need? And what you're actually doing there, you're arousing the mindfulness, you're investigating in the right area, and you're actually getting to know the right time for things. So it's great. The Pali version, Anguttara 7.64, has a slightly more mundane goal. This support is just to encourage those that the Buddha would have probably held a retreat like you. Think the Buddha would have told silly jokes, though. But we do that because of the change of audience. Maybe in India, or maybe in Thailand. When I was a young monk, you couldn't do that in Thailand. You couldn't tell jokes. Not in public, anyway. All the monks, you know, when the lay people had gone, they were just like little kids telling jokes, poking each other, having a great time. But in public, we had to put on this face of being serious. And that's why for many years, as few Thais have noticed, you weren't allowed to smile. When you had a photo taken, you know, you were told, don't smile. And only later on did the monks start to smile, because they realized, why not? This is actually who we are and how we are. And actually the lay people actually appreciated it more. February, I gave a retreat in Hong Kong. And it was in a Mahayana temple, but led by a Theravada monk. You know, so Theravada monk was running this Mahayana temple, doing a great job. It's wonderful. See, Theravada Mahayana, who cares? So they were there together, running it. So I was doing this retreat. So it was a couple of Mahayana Chinese nuns. And at the end of the retreat, one of them came up to me and said, oh, thank you so much for coming to our temple, telling jokes and laughing and smiling. Because I used to smile when I first became a nun. And my disciples, the lay people, said, stop it, you're not supposed to smile. You're a Buddhist nun. Now they've seen you, I can smile again. Thank you so much, Ajahn Brahm. And that's what she told me. Now, what would you like to see? Serious nuns, serious monks, or smiling monks and nuns? Anyway, here we go. In Majjhima 99, people have been reading the suttas, it's amazing. Imagine verse 99, the Buddha gave the simile of the pleasure of the senses as a flame fueled by grass, twigs as a supernatural psychic flame like the pleasures of meditation. Please explain the cause of the bliss, it has no fuel. Okay, imagine 99, the simile of the pleasures of the five senses as a flame fueled by grass, twigs, etc. In other words, as soon as the fuel, the grass and the twigs disappear, so does your pleasure. And that's the problem with the sensory world. As soon as you get the most delicious meal, which you pay a lot of money for, and how long does it take to eat? 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and it's all gone. You go and see a great movie, afterwards it's just gone. Great sex, how long does it last? Gone. Actually, I was told that I'm not supposed to mention that word in some countries. I'm a monk who actually mentions the S-E-X word. But look, I mean, the Buddha actually said you've got to teach in the local language. And my goodness, Ajahn Chah and his monks used to say some coarse language many times. The most coarsest words, you know, for genitalia in public. And that's why he was very popular in that northeast of Thailand, because he taught at the local level. So you've got to do that. At least I haven't got as much courage as Ajahn Chah had, but you know, much more than many other monks have. But anyway, the flame fueled by causes. When those causes like grass and twigs disappear, so does the pleasure. So what happens after the pleasure of the senses? When happiness disappears, is suffering, the absence of pleasure. That's what suffering is. The absence of suffering is what pleasure, what absence of suffering is pleasure, absence of pleasure is suffering. That's why I've gone on record many times. It's a very great teaching. What is pleasure anyway but the space between two moments of suffering? What is suffering but the space between two moments of pleasure? They lean against each other. You can't have one without the other. But the pleasures of meditation, like a supernatural psychic flame, in other words, without any fuel, because the pleasures of meditation are not depending on things They're depending on the absence of things. These are the pleasures of vanishing, of disappearing. So they're not dependent upon the existence of things. They're dependent upon things disappearing, vanishing. That's why when you get into the deep meditations, you'll notice so many things have vanished. And that's why it's pleasurable. Even coming on this retreat is a pleasurable place. Why? Because so many things have vanished when you're here. For many of you, because there's mostly women here, your husband has vanished. Aho sukhang, aho sukhang. Oh, what joy. For me, my monastery has vanished. Aho sukhang, aho sukhang. It's not here. For some of you, your work, your job has vanished. Aho sukhang. For some of you, your kitchen has vanished. Aho sukhang. Wonderful. So you can actually see that many of the pleasures of being on retreat is because things have vanished, they've disappeared. You don't have to worry about them. Now imagine going even deeper. Your body disappears. Many of you get old. It's amazing how many people, you know, wait till their 40s, 50s and 60s before they start learning meditation. They start to get desperate by that time. So all you desperate people coming close to dying, trying to get your act together before it's too late, meditate. You can see what's actually happening here. Your body aches. My body always aches. There's always something wrong with it. I suffer from hay fever. My nose is always itchy. Sometimes, you know, the saliva goes to the back of the throat. You feel a bit of a cough and irritation in the back. The knees ache. The back aches. It's a bit too hot for me. I prefer it colder. Many of you, it's too cold. You prefer it hotter. Sometimes you're thirsty. You've got to go to the toilet. There's always something going on. So when you get into meditation, your body disappears. Oh, sukhang. I don't have to worry about this irritating thing called my body. It's always just on my back, asking me to scratch it, to feed it, to take it to the core. It's just the most irritating thing in the whole world, your body. And if you don't look after it, it throws a tantrum. You get sick. So in deep meditation, the body disappears. Now that is what the Buddha is saying is happiness. Happiness from disappearance. Not based on things existing, but things disappearing. That's why it's a different pleasure. And that's why it's a pleasure to go for. Any questions on that? Oh, okay, next question. A relationship question. What is the relationship between allowing things to be and love? Are they the same thing? Do you love your partner? Do you allow him to do whatever he wants to do? Do you allow him to be, you know, to be selfish and to be flirting with your best friends? Do you allow him to be? Or do you want to control him? Allowing things to be in love. First of all, what most people think is love, especially the love in a relationship. I've got this acid test, this way that you can understand if you really do love your partner. Many people actually say they love their partner, and they just want their partner to be happy. Your happiness, darling, is the most important thing in the world to me. Ha ha ha. The test is this. When you go home after this retreat, and you find a letter in your apartment or house from your partner who said, since you went away on your retreat, I've also gone away. I've gone away with your best friend to have a sexual liaison in Bali. How would you feel? If you really loved your partner, if their happiness was the most important thing in the world to you, you'd be overjoyed. Oh, I'm so happy, darling, that you're having an even greater time having sex with my best friend than having it with me. I am so overjoyed that you're happy and having a great time. Wonderful. You make me so inspired and uplifted knowing that you're happy in Bali with my best friend. Of course you can't do that because you don't love your partner. You're attached to them. In other words, your love is totally conditioned. Wanting them to please you, what, you know, giving them rules to keep in those boundaries. But real love is boundless. The door of my heart is open to you, partner, no matter what you ever do, no matter where you ever go. Can you do that? No way. Some of you can, and well done, because that's real love. Can you do that to yourself? You've got, how many more days of this retreat? 7, 8 days left. Me. The door of my heart is open to me. I love me so much that if I spend the next 7 or 8 days just sleeping and eating, that I will love me so much, I'll be so happy. Well done, I've had a great retreat. I haven't even sat in this meditation hall once. I haven't attended any talks. All I've ever attended is breakfast, lunch and tea. Well done. So that is what love is. No blame, total acceptance. And if you could do that, you wouldn't need to meditate. With no guilt. Ajahn, this morning you talked about non-necessity of asking questions, giving examples of your visit to see Ajahn Tate, and how questions increased during the duration of the retreat, which you seem to indicate was unnecessary. At Nolamari you said, one who does not ask questions will be reborn stupid. Ah, have they got me? How could I escape this one? Also, it is written in Sutta, where the Buddha admonishes a monk for not asking questions on the Dhamma when uncertain of the correct meaning. Ah, because it is one who does not ask questions will be reborn stupid. That's because they already are stupid. Because you're stupid, that's why you ask questions. But how many questions have you asked in your life? And how many of those answers have really helped you? So look, get the big answer to the big question. You know that, what was that in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? They actually found the answer before they knew the question. The answer was 42. And then they forgot what the question was. So it took them another book to find out what the question was. But I'll tell you the answer, and then you can work out what the question is. And of course, you all know this because it's one of my favorite stories. The answer is, there is nothing. So now you've got to work out what the question is. That's a much better way. Instead of asking questions and getting answers, I'll give you the answer. Now you work out the question. Ajahn, can you please explain some techniques on walking meditation? Yeah. You lift your left foot, put it forward, go down. Lift your right foot, put it forward, put it down. You've all walked before, haven't you? So be serious, because it's a decent question. When you're doing walks, just doing sitting meditation, you get a sore bottom, a sore head, everything gets sore if you sit down for too long. So it's great to do walking meditation. That's why we've got 3 halls built at great expense, you know, for you to do walking meditation. And we cared about you so much, we put red carpets there. That's how much that we value this red carpets for you to walk on doing walking meditation. That's a red carpet treatment for you. So what do? You start at one end and then you go to the other end. You turn around and go back again. Now, you're not getting anywhere, are you? That's one of the great things about walking meditation. You end up where you started. Totally going against this idea of doing something to get something out of it. Try and reach something, try and attain something, try and learn something. You just don't know where you started from. That's why I love. I've seen some very wonderful, innovative people doing walking meditation around the stupas. That's even more profound. You just go round and round and round and round and round. Just like life. So, number one, you walk not intending to get anywhere. Keep the intention not to gain things, not to get things, not to change things, but to be here. So when you're walking, be here, wherever you happen to be. At the beginning, you're mindful, I am here at the beginning of the path. In the middle, two-thirds across, I am here two-thirds across the path. I am at the end of the path. Just be here. And as you are walking, what should you be thinking? Make peace. Be kind. Be gentle. Walk peacefully. Be kind to your body as you're walking. And walk really gently. And if you just make peace, be kind, be gentle when you're walking, quite naturally, you'll just walk, not thinking about all the things which you can think about in the world, which are endless. Not dreaming, not sort of worrying about things, because one of the nice things about these walking paths here, if you go dreaming and lose your mindfulness, you hit the wall. And that hurts. So, has that happened to anybody yet? I know it did happen to some people, because I remember they were trying to sort of go without sleep, and they go in the halls there. That's actually in Thailand. Because we used to do this all-night meditation, and sometimes people would be doing the walking meditation, and suddenly you hear a bang. They hit their head on the walls. It's so funny. Not for them, of course, everyone watching. But, so, you're mindful. Because you're making peace, being kind, being gentle. That's how you develop your mindfulness. You get strong. You're aware, you're here. Just making peace with this moment. Being kind to it, being gentle. And then just be aware of all the movements in the feet. This will happen naturally, but those of you who want to actually do something, because it's a bit difficult for you just to let things be, the teaching a bit too profound, what you can do is you can be aware of what foot is moving, left foot or right foot. At least that stops you going into sort of dreams and fantasies and what sort. So just do left foot or right foot. And then the next stage, from the very beginning, first stage, present moment awareness. Second stage, I know you're just in the moment when you're walking. Second stage, be silent, shut up, so you can feel the movement of the feet rather than talking about it. And the third stage, so you know left foot moving, right foot moving. The fourth stage, the beginning of the left foot moving. You see all the different sensations in the legs as one foot moves forward and then comes to the ground again. But you know that's not what you do. That's what happens. If you try and do that and force it, you're just playing. It's not natural, it's forced. You'll never be peaceful that way. Just let it happen. As you're sitting there, just being here, making peace, being kind, being gentle, that's what will happen. You come into the present moment. You become silent. There's nothing going on in your head, no thoughts. Instead, you're aware of the feet moving, because that's the only thing which is doing anything. And then that awareness of the feet moving gets more and more clear, more profound. Until you're walking there and amazed at all the different feelings in the feet. Just one step is just incredible. Thousands of feelings, all different. Are you seeing them all? That's how you do walking meditation. Becoming still, mindful, and blissed out. Happily just walking, enjoying every moment. I will mention more about that tomorrow. Because I was going to, if I'm still alive tomorrow, I was going to talk about vanishing. And I'll talk about that in the context of walking meditation as well. I find it hard to keep my mind focused for a long period of time. Exactly. So don't try. Let your mind just be unfocused. Then it'll be focused. However, at times I see a bright light varying in color from yellow to purple when my concentration persists undisturbed. Is it an unusual experience with metta? Yeah, it's a nimitta, but if you're trying to get that nimitta, it won't be stable. I talk a lot about nimittas. These are the lights which appear in the mind. And as soon as I start talking about it, people say, I want, I want, I want. I'm a meditator too. I want to experience this. And I'd be really upset if I don't experience a nimitta during this retreat. In fact, I'll ask for my money back. And I'll write a complaint to the Buddhist Society of West Australia. Ajahn Brahm was a terrible teacher. He never taught me how to get nimittas. So nimittas are there, but don't try and get them, because a nimitta happens when you've let go a lot. You have created the the conditions of peace, of stillness, of letting go, so that nimitta can come. If you want them to come, you are stopping them from coming. Everything in meditation goes wrong when you try, when you want things. So don't try to keep your mind focused. Because you're trying, that is why it won't focus. Leave it alone. Make peace. Be kind. Be gentle. Rest. And then the mind becomes still. That's what focused is. When it's still, it's not moving here, it's not moving there, it's staying put. You are not focusing it. You're bringing the mind to its natural state of stillness. This is my old simile. I do this so many times, but it comes in here. Bottle of water. I'm bored telling the story. But anyway, bottle of water. Let's put some energy into it. I'm now going to hold my bottle of water still. Dania, you are the closest. You've done this before. You know exactly what to say, but be honest. Is it still yet? Okay, I will try harder. I get a focus. Very good. I'm going to put effort in. This is how people meditate. They try and hold their mind still. And they wonder, I can't meditate. Please help me. Look, that is not how you meditate. How do you meditate? Put it down. Now, when I put it down, it moves more. When you let go, your mind will be more restless, more tired. That's its nature. But wait for a while. Dania, is it moving? Be honest. Exactly. So I'm not patient enough. I've got to wait a bit longer. Very good. That's how you meditate. That's why meditation is easy when you understand what meditation is. Stillness. Once that water is still, then it can reflect things like nimittas. And those nimittas stay. They don't go anywhere. You get beautiful mind states. But you do anything, that is a problem. Is the nimitta yet? No, not yet. Coming? No, not yet. Is it still? Come on, be still. I told you to be still. When are you going to be still? Stupid bottle. That's actually how people meditate. So you put it down and you wait and are patient. Then, nimittas just happen. It's a sign the mind is becoming still. And it's become still because you've left it alone. You put it down. So the reason I keep repeating that simile, because that is dead accurate of how people meditate and how not to meditate. According to Buddhist teaching, what is the explanation given for convictions for crimes they never did? What is the path open to the person convicted to come out of the mental trauma? Thank you for your answer. Yeah, I was convicted for the crime of ordaining bhikkhunis. I never did it. Ayatata Loka did it. It's true. So what is the path open to the person convicted to come out of the mental trauma? I just let it go. So, okay, if it's you got convicted of another crime you never did. So suppose I got convicted of, say, burglary. I never did it. I think, wonderful, I get sent to jail. You know, in jail, you can get your own room, and it's got a shower. I get 3 meals a day in jail. And if I want to do a retreat, it's easy. All I need to do is punch a prison officer. Automatically, you get a month solitary. So I think, wow, wonderful. That's what you should do. You get convicted of a crime you didn't do. Wonderful. Now, this is not a joke, because some of the Thai people, remember, there was, what was his name? He was a Somdet, one of the very senior monks in Thailand. He was actually the second in line to become the Sangha Raja of Thailand. The next in line to become the Sangha Raja, very, very good monk. And the third in line was jealous. So the third in line, you know, wanted to somehow get rid of the person who's going to stop him becoming Sangharaja. So he, this was in the 60s, so he accused him of being a communist because of some of the things he said in his talks. That's why that, you know, I've said so many things in my talks. You can accuse me of anything. You can accuse me of being a left-wing communist, a fascist, anything, because I've said so many. You can always take something out of context. So he was accused of being a communist. The charge stuck, and he was sent to jail for 2 years. In the meantime, the old Sangharaja died, and this guy became the new Sangharaja. He actually, his plan worked. He managed to get to the top. And then, I think a few months after he became the Sangharaja, there was a fatal car crash. He had a police escort, police car in front, police car behind, in the limousine, whatever he was travelling in. A car on the other side of the road, about Don Mueang Airport or somewhere, veered across the road and slammed into the car and just injured one person, killed him, the Sangharaja. Everyone else was fine. And this, in Thailand, was thought, this is really weird. A big car crash, the only person killed was the Sangharaja. No one else was injured. This must be the result of some karma. So what did this guy do? And they all realized that he was the guy behind sending this monk to jail. And so, it actually released this monk from jail. And they apologized. He was at the abbot of Wat Mahathat. They apologized to him. And he said, what are you apologizing for? I had a wonderful time. I had 2 years, had no people visiting me, no need to give any talks. I could read, had beautiful food, had my own cell. It was like a meditation retreat for 2 years. I had a great time. Now that's the attitude of, you know, of a great Buddhist. He was put in jail for nothing he did, just because jealousy. And he put, but what did he do with it? He made the most out of it. And he said, some of the best 2 years of my life, especially when he was in that position, always being the beck and call of his disciples. And now he was in jail for 2 years. Retreat time. He had a great time. So that's the way to deal with it. So if you're accused of something you didn't do, and you're convicted, no matter what, make the best use of it. Make any sense? Maybe that worked in China. If that was actually maybe in Iran or somewhere and you got sort of executed, that might be a bit difficult. But nevertheless, could you please explain about walking meditation in terms of what we should focus on? You know, present moment, silence, feet, etc. But the main thing is making peace, being kind, being gentle. What is the purpose of this meditation? How much depth do we need to focus? You don't do anything, let it happen. You don't do anything, let it happen. You don't do anything, let it happen. You get out of the way. Get out of all this controlling, making things happen. If you do that, meditation, walking, whatever, really takes off. You try and make it happen, you get to a certain level, you can't go any deeper. So if you get the message, start walking, just see what happens. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle with every step. Then you have a wonderful time. The relationship difference between mind and conscious. Can you please explain, Ajahn? No. Can I say no? Mind and consciousness, basically they're the same. Even in the time of the Buddha, they would use the words interchangeably. That's why wrong view number 8 in the Brahmajala Sutta, Digha Nikaya, the Buddha said, that which you call that singular, which you call mind or consciousness, it's a different finer word, mano, vijnana, and citta. That one thing which people call any of those three terms, some people say is permanent and persists past the death of enlightened one. That's wrong view number 8. I often quote that because it's one place there that the Buddha is making very clear that those words were used synonymously in the time of the Buddha. Mind, consciousness, citta. Even, for those who know Pali, even in the Potapada Sutta, they use sanya in terms of consciousness. You know, basically, just even sanya, perception, was used by some people as an alternative to consciousness. So some of these words are not used precisely. So that's why mind and consciousness, you can use them the same. And there is one sense where they're different, and that's consciousness. This is an interesting piece of Dhamma. Consciousness. What is consciousness anyway? The Buddha said there are six totally different types of consciousness. Totally different animals, if you like. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and mind. But there's something similar to each one of these. Seeing and hearing. What is similar to that? To what those ones? What's similar to seeing and feeling in the body? What's similar is we know that we saw something. We know we felt. And what actually happens, those of you who get some decent meditation, your mindfulness will show you that when you see something, then the mind comes in and knows what you saw. When you hear something, you hear the words, and then the mind knows you've heard. What's happening is sight consciousness is immediately followed by mind consciousness. And then hearing consciousness followed by mind consciousness. That's how you know you've heard. And because mind consciousness follows all the other consciousnesses, that gives it the simile, that gives it the feeling of sameness. That's where the similarity comes from. Mind consciousness follows right after every other consciousness. Otherwise, if you just had feeling conscious, smell consciousness, you would know that it's totally different. It's a different animal. Because the mind consciousness follows every other consciousness, it gives it the sense of sameness. And from that sameness, the illusion of continuity. And the illusion of continuity of consciousness is where many of us get the delusion of the self. So ever since you heard me begin this evening session, you've been continually conscious, or have you? It feels that way, doesn't it? There's been a being here listening to the talk ever since it began. If you look at it more closely with greater mindfulness, you see it was hearing, knowing, hearing, knowing, hearing, knowing. Maybe some touching, knowing, touching, knowing. You've had a whole range of totally independent conscious moments ever since it taught. There was no continuity at all. In my book I gave the simile of the beach. You look at a beach and it's a continuous stretch of sand from a distance. That continuity is an illusion. You go closer and you find the beach is made up of individual particles of sand. And if you look closer, there's a gap between those particles. They're not even touching. What you thought was continuous has holes in it, gaps. That which you thought was a continuation of your conscious, of yourself, has spaces in it. Gaps. You disappeared. But you never noticed it. If you understand that, it unravels the illusion of a self based on the continuity or the apparent continuity of your consciousness. So that's mind and consciousness. Knowing the difference in that aspect will unravel the illusion that you are listening to me right now. You are not. You're not paying me any attention at all. Just your consciousness is hearing me. That's all. If there's no one there, that's why we have to let go. If there was someone there, then you should be striving. Because there's no one there. Who the heck is striving anyway? It's just a myth. Stop striving. Why? Because there's no one there. Do you understand that? No, you don't. If reincarnation is true, why other religions, i.e. Christianity, Muslim, do not believe it? Look, they don't believe it in this life, but in their next life they will. That's why. And Christians did believe in reincarnation in the early in their early years. It's only later on they decided not to believe in it. Of course it's reincarnation. They call it resurrection. So they just have one reincarnation. Look at even Good Friday today, or Execution Day. Jesus got reincarnated 3 days and he was reincarnated again. Is that reincarnation? One way of looking at it. What about all these evangelicals? They call themselves born again Christians. That's reincarnation. Be born twice. But sometimes the reason why people don't believe it, because they don't want to believe it, because it just messes up a lot of their theology. And because they will always bend the truth so to fit their faith. In other words, because their faith says no, therefore they will bend the truth. And they say, no, there can't be reincarnation. Why? What's the evidence? Because it doesn't say so in the Bible. It's not in the Quran. Whatever else it is, their faith tells them not to believe it. Because my teacher told me not to believe in it. And to me, that's no way to be wise. So, if you want to be wise, sort of don't bend the truth to fit your faith. Bend your faith to fit the truth. Any faith you have in whatever part of Buddhism, any idea you have about what the Buddha taught, what I say, what you believe, be willing to bend it, to change it, to fit the truth as it comes up to you. That's the path of wisdom. So, there we go. That's the last question tonight. But the night is still young. If you were going out with your friends, you'd be out, it's Friday night, the end of the working week. You'd be out having lunch, having dinner. I was teaching this retreat in Malacca, and there was many people from Singapore came along. And I thought, out of compassion, I should end at about 9:30, 10 o'clock, so everyone can go to bed. And what did the Singaporeans do? They didn't go to bed. They went to the restaurants and the cafe. And they were out so late. They're supposed to be staying in the temple in the Sekhi Inn temple. And they got locked out. And they had to get someone to ring up the president so he could open the door for the Singaporeans. And I thought, my goodness. I thought I finished early so you can go to bed. But no, they wanted me to finish early so they could go out eating. But you can't do that here. That's why it's a wonderful retreat center. There's no cafes in the area. You're stuffed. There's no way. You've got to wait till tomorrow morning. So it's great. So those of you who want to have a rest, have a rest. If you want to sort of meditate, have a meditate. So ask your body, ask your mind. Mind, what do you want? What do you need? Body, what about you? What do you really want? If your body says, look, I'm really tired, take me to bed. Okay. And if the body says, no, come on, I'm fit. I want to just meditate some more. I want to make the best use of this opportunity. There's only 60 people who are allowed to come on this retreat. That's you. You're so lucky. Many people are just so disappointed they couldn't go on this retreat. And you're going to go to bed now? Think about all the people you've displaced. So whatever it is, motivate yourself. Maybe not the first couple of nights, and take it easy. But later on, motivate yourself. So you should, if you really are following the instructions, you're letting go, making peace, being kind, being gentle, your energy level should start increasing. Which means you actually want to meditate more. So, if you want to go to bed now, go to bed now. But when you wake up in the morning, start meditating again. So that way, you are being natural, asking your body what it needs, and having a great time. Okay, so I'll see you all in the morning. Have a happy night. Happy meditating.